KBOO Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present the May film in the monthly sex workers film series, Mr. Angel, on Friday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. Shot over 6 years, Mr. Angel is a documentary that chronicles the life of Buck Angel, a transgender advocate, educator, and porn pioneer. Again, that's Friday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street. More information about this film and the Sex Workers film series can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
May 2nd, 12 noon to 1:30, I will be featuring the music of Lori Lewis. The San Francisco Bay Area was a hotbed of traditional and acoustic music beginning in the 1960s. Starting with the Arkansas Sheiks and the Good Old Persons, she then started her own band, the Grant Street String Band. For the last dozen years, she and her partner, Tom Rosen, have fronted her band, always attracting the highest quality musicians. Blending traditional and contemporary material, she has forged a unique sound. A limited number of One Evening in May, her brand new CD, will be available as a thank you gift for your membership. Tune in Friday, May 2nd, 12 noon to 1:30.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what's coming up on this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock. That's right about now. It's 9:02. Political Perspectives, Per Frogering speaks with radio host Tom Hartman, author of over 20 books, about his latest, The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America, and What We Can Do to Stop It. At 9:30, the guest is Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of Reigniting the Labor Movement. He'll talk about the economic benefits of single-payer universal health care for low-wage workers, unions, and community groups. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And then at 10:15, on Flashpoints, an encore report on U.S.-supported wars against the Democratic Republic of Congo. Also, fiction writers in occupied Palestine speak out. And at 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, Jimmy Tardy, hosts S. Brian Wilson and Mike Hasty in the KBOO studios to talk about Kent State shootings with survivor Joe Lewis, about the shootings, the war, and what it all means. And once again, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can easily become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now we go right to Per Frogering with his guest, Tom Hartman.
Well, good morning. This is Per Frogering, Political Perspectives, and my guest is Tom Hartman, the radio host, and he will be speaking here in Portland at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Main, and he will be there with community friends, and this will be a community commons kind of thing. So they'll be tabling from 6 o'clock on, and there'll be about 40 organizations there. So you can come early, meet people from all these different Portland community organizations, and then Tom and friends will be speaking at 7 o'clock. And it's a modest admission, but no one will be turned away. So Tom Hartman, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Per, it's great to be back with you. How are you?
Yeah, doing okay. Well, you know, your book is The Crash of 2016. It occurs to me that's not very far away, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, I'd say that the crash is ongoing right now as we speak. It's it became visible to everybody, I think, in 2007, 2008 with the housing and stock market crashes. And we've been blowing this bubble back up and trying to hold this phony economy together with baling wire and bubble gum, but it ain't going to last.
Well, in your book, you mentioned that you know, the corporations are hoarding cash. They've got stashed, and this is 2 years ago, $1.45 trillion stashed away. That's almost $1.5 trillion.
Yeah.
And the world's
rich. It's over $3 trillion now.
$3 trillion. Oh my! Yeah. And the world's rich have stashed away $32 trillion. That's a lot of money.
That number, by some guesstimates, is over $40 trillion. It's a mind-boggling amount of money. It's really nice to see, for example, Thomas Piketty's new book about, you know, capital, mm-hmm. and how capitalism doesn't produce the nice, warm, fuzzy middle class that we've been sold, and that only well-regulated capitalism, like we had before Reaganomics, can actually produce a middle class, and can also produce a stable economy that is not subject to crashes. I mean, in my book, I talk about, and I'll be talking Friday night in Portland at the Unitarian Church about how our history. It seems like almost every 80 years we have a crash followed by a war, and it's like what happens is that we get really, really stupid. And then we do something really stupid, like the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 99 and 2000 that set up the most recent crisis. And then we have a horrible crash and a war, and that teaches us the lesson that, boy, we shouldn't have done that. And for 60 years, about 60 years, we remember that lesson. And then the people who are old enough to remember the lesson die off. And I think it was, well, actually, I'm not sure. The quote has been attributed to a number of people. But the old saying that when the last person who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable because people don't remember the mistakes. They don't remember the horrors. And the last person, I mean, people who remember the Great Depression now, who lived through it, by and large, are no longer have a say in the political world. And, you know, when they do try to warn us, it's like, be careful there. And then, grandpa, go back to watching Fox News. And it's so sad that, 80 years ago is the Great Depression, World War II. 80 years before that, it was the Great Crash of 1857, followed by the Civil War. 80 years before that, it was the crash of 1770, followed by the American Revolution. 80 years before that, there was another crash that was followed by a rather significant rebellion against the British that didn't rise to American Revolution standards, but it was still there. Mm-hmm. It was arguably the multi-generational precursor. And 80 years before that was the War of the Roses, which followed a crash. And so I'm pointing out, this is the arc of history, and we just, the problem that we have is that we didn't fix the problem. I mean, FDR came in after the last great crash. The American people had 3 years of the horrors of the consequences of Hardingomics, which is the same thing as Reaganomics. Warren Harding was elected in 1920 on a platform of more business in government, less government in business. In other words, privatize everything and deregulate everything, which he did. And cutting taxes on the rich. He dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%, just like Reagan did, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, it led to a bubble, the Roaring Twenties, and a crash. And Reaganomics led to actually a series of bubbles, the dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, the stock market bubble, and a series of crashes. The biggest one being the stock market bubble. That's the one that typically takes down everything. But when FDR came in, the American people for 3 years, they had 3 years to figure out what was going on and who the villains were. And when Obama came in, we'd had 6 months, and I don't think it had really sunk in yet to Americans how horrible it could be, and how it happened and why it happened and who the villains were. And, they've been just for 6 years now, very aggressively, this whole, you know, right-wing machine has been trying to convince Americans that the economy stinks because Obama, you know, because of Benghazi, because of IRS, whatever, you know, it's anything other than the failure of unregulated capitalism and the greed of the plutocrats.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are the corporations going to do with all this money? I mean, they're going to, you know, they're sitting on it now. I mean, can they buy rental property or farmland? I mean, in your book, you say they know what's coming.
Yeah, they've already done both of those things. In fact, rental property is the next. It started about 4 years ago. These big private equity companies and investment houses are buying up vast swaths of distressed home, you know, homes in foreclosure, where the banksters have robbed and ripped off average Americans. There's about three to four million of them available, and they've been buying these things up, and now they're renting them out. And which is creating a renting bubble. It's driving up rents. And it's also, they're making derivatives out of these things. And they're selling them overseas where into unregulated markets. So
yeah, tell us about the derivatives, exactly what they are, because you say that the global derivatives market is $1.2 quadrillion. This is beyond trillion, folks. We're up in the quadrillion. What's going to happen with that?
Well, just to put this all in perspective, the gross domestic product, the sum total of all activity in the United States, government activity, private sector activity, personal activity, all the buying and selling that goes on in the United States in a year is around $15 trillion. On the planet, it's around $54 trillion. That's the GDP for the entire planet.
Mm-hmm.
A derivative is basically a bet. It derives its value from an underlying asset that actually has value, which is why it's called a derivative. And so the last derivative bubble was on mortgages. The mortgages had an underlying value, presumably. It turns out they didn't. They were, you know, these liar loans and things, many of them. But at least there were mortgages and at least there was property. So there was an underlying value. And then you have a primary ownership of that, and you tranche that, you slice that into thousands of little slices, and then you have an insurance policy on it, basically. That's what AIG was all about, and, you know, on whether or not this mortgage is going to go bad, which is a bet. And then you can have an insurance policy on the insurance policy. So you start out with $1 million worth of slice of mortgages, you put a $100 million bet on that, so you leverage it, you know, 100 to 1. So if it goes up or down by 1%, you make $1 million or lose $1 million. And then you, on that $100 million derivative, you can make $1 billion bet. And then on that $1 billion derivative, you can make a $10 billion bet. You can see how this is like the old, you know, double the wheat on the chessboard thing. This thing, you can just explode exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this was made possible because Ken Lay, when he was running Enron, wanted to get into the banking business, and he wanted to be able to play these kind of games with energy derivatives, and he couldn't do either because the Glass-Steagall Act prevented banks from engaging in gambling. And the gambling houses who participated in commodities were regulated by the Chicago Board of Trade and by the Federal Commodities Regulator. Who was Wendy Graham for a while during the Clinton administration. She was Phil Graham's wife. And she left that group and went to be on the board of Enron. And Phil Graham proposed these two pieces of legislation, Graham-Leach-Bliley, which did away with Glass-Steagall so that banks could gamble with their depositors' money, and especially Enron could. They could gamble with their own money. And the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which said that these banks can not only gamble, but they can gamble with commodities, and derivatives are considered commodities. Typically, commodities used to be like wheat and oil and pork bellies and things. They can gamble with commodities, and they can do it in an unregulated marketplace. So we went, in the last years of the Clinton administration, from having a few $100 billion worth of derivatives, basically no derivative market at all. It was just an insurance market. We went from that to having having trillions of dollars in 2000 worth of derivatives, 2001, to having tens of trillions of dollars by 2002, to having hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives in 2003 and 2004, to having over $1,000 trillion worth of derivatives by 2006. That's a quadrillion, $1,000 trillion. Again, keep in mind, the GDP of the entire planet is only $54 trillion.
Wow.
So this is an amount of money that we're not talking monopoly money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when the mortgage market, the underlying value behind those derivatives started to collapse because people couldn't pay their LIR loans or had no intention or whatever, then the derivatives started to crash. And when the derivatives started to crash, they threatened to take down the banks. And we stepped in and bailed them out. And the Fed, you know, Bernie Sanders got that one-year audit of the Fed and passed through his law. And it turned out that the Fed had loaned out $32 trillion, not just to banks, but there were a lot of rich people who were involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fed actually gave rich individuals money to keep them from going down.
Oh, my. Well,
so, yeah, it's a bizarre system, mm-hmm. and we never got rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
We should have. I mean, at least, you know, I very rarely speak well of Ronald Reagan, but at least when Reagan deregulated the SNLs in 1983, he set up the crash of the SNLs in 1986-87. I mean, he just set it right up. He deregulated them. He did the same thing Gramm-Leach-Bliley did with the banks. And the SNLs immediately began gambling like crazy, and they crashed.
Mm-hmm.
And so what did he do? He went in, he prosecuted 1,000 people. Over 800 went to prison. Thomas Keating, the most famous among
mm-hmm.
them.
Oh, yes, yes.
And he nationalized the SNLs. He literally mm-hmm. said to the stockholders, "You guys are screwed. You've lost all your money. Goodbye, go away."
Mm-hmm.
He said to the senior management of all these SNLs, "You're fired. You know, go on the unemployment line." And he brought in federal banking regulators to run the SNLs. He put a guy named Bill Seidman in charge of the whole thing. He created this organization called the Resolution Trust Corporation. And over the next 25 years, at a profit to the government, they gradually sold these SNLs back into the private marketplace and reprivatized them, denationalized them.
Mm-hmm.
Sweden did the exact same thing in 1997 with their entire banking system when it crashed because of an experiment in neoliberalism like this. And that's what George Bush should have done in 2008 when the banks started falling apart and crashing. He should have done what Reagan did. He should have done what Sweden did. He should have done what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933 when he was sworn in and every bank in America crashed the week before he was sworn in. There was plenty of precedent. It was easy to do, but instead, you know, the rich banksters in New York who donate so much money to both parties said, no, bail us out. Don't cut us off. Don't make us go away. And that's what Reagan did, and he did it twice. In fact, there were two TARPs under Reagan, plus the $30 trillion Fed bailout. And then Obama came into office, and Obama had an opportunity, arguably, during his first year to reverse that policy and chose not to, presumably for the same reason, because the banksters fund the Democrats, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are with
here we are.
this horribly broken system.
Wow, well, this is Per Fagerang. My guest is Tom Hartman, who will be in town Friday, May 2nd. That's this coming Friday, and he'll be talking about his book, The Crash of 2016. He will be at the First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th and Main, and he'll be there with community friends, and there'll be a lot of tables from different community organizations, and they'll be tabling from 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. on, and then Tom and friends will be speaking at 7. So that is Friday. Coming right up at the Unitarian Church at 12th and Main. And
as you said, this is going to be the Commons, just like KBOO is part of the Commons.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let me just put in a plug for KBOO, too. People really need to, if they're listening to KBOO, they really need to be supporting KBOO.
That's right. Our pledge drive starts tomorrow.
Great. Well, I wish you the very best on it.
So...
If I can help in any way, let me know.
Well, just by being there and talking it up, and I'm pretty sure KBOO will have a presence at the event Friday. So why don't we talk about some of the things we can do about this? I suppose that'll be what some of the friends and community organizations will be trying to do. So how do we get out of this fix we're in?
The number one problem that we have, Per, right now, is arguably the number one problem we had at the end of the last Gilded Age when the great crash of 1896 happened. And that is that there is so much power associated with money, political power associated with money, because there is so little regulation of money in the political realm that the billionaires basically and the large corporations basically control our political system. And during the last progressive revolution, after the Great Crash of 1896, that led right to the Tillman Act in 1907, which made it a felony for a corporation to give money to a political candidate. It led directly to many states, including Oregon, putting into place laws that said that the citizens can go around their corrupt legislatures and enact citizen ballot initiatives. It led directly to the direct election of senators. It led to the enfranchisement of women. And, you know, a whole bunch of progressive reforms, and ultimately, that, you know, at the capstone of all that, I would argue, was the Wagner Act, you know, the National Labor Relations Act of 32 and 33, and Social Security and all these other things. So, but the first thing that we have to do is what Teddy Roosevelt did in 1907 was, you know, outlawed money in politics. And the problem that we have is that our Supreme Court, I mean, we sort of did that after all the Nixon scandals. We put real severe limits on money in politics. And then McCain-Feingold, in some ways, weakened some of them, in some ways, strengthened others, but, you know, had substantial limits on politics. But then the Supreme Court came along and said, you can't do that because we have discovered that in the First Amendment, there's money. Money is covered by the First Amendment. Somehow George Washington fought the Revolutionary War, you know, not for the average American, not even for the plantation owners, but he fought the Revolutionary War for the multi-billionaires in Europe, the East India Company, the giant transnational corporations, and that's why the First Amendment's there. It protects money. Now, historically, the Supreme Court has always said that money is a behavior. You know, and money is not speech. It's an action that can be regulated. But now, you know, since the Buckley case and the First National Bank versus Bilotti and the Citizens United case, the Supreme Court has said that money is speech. So we need to have a constitutional amendment, which sounds very difficult, but actually in 1971 we amended the Constitution to lower the voting age to 18, and it took 3 months and 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
If you get the popular opinion on your side, you can make this happen fast.
Well, I think the logic behind this reform would be that an election is sort of like a debate. You know, you have candidates with solutions to some problem, and they get a chance to present their solution, and then the people get a chance to vote on it. That's what a debate is all about. But the way the Supreme Court has it set up, some candidates would get to speak maybe 10 times as long as the other candidates, and they get a louder microphone, and you don't have a debate. It's more of, I don't know what they would call it, some kind of a free-for-all shouting match or something, but it's not what it's supposed to be.
Right. You're absolutely right. And so we need to amend the Constitution to say two very simple things. That George Washington didn't fight the Revolutionary War for the billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
He was not a billionaire, and most of the people fighting in the Revolution were not. So money is not in the First Amendment. Money is not speech, A. And then B, Abraham Lincoln did not fight the Civil War to free the corporations. He fought the Civil War to free the slaves, in large part. And so the 14th Amendment does not protect corporations. And so if we simply strip out of from, and these are both judge-created laws. No legislature has ever, in the history of America, federal or state, argued and passed legislation that's been signed by executives, by governors or presidents, that says that corporations are people and protected by the 14th Amendment, or that money is speech and is protected by the First Amendment. It's never happened. Only the Supreme Court has ever said that. And so we need to pass a constitutional amendment to reverse this judge-made law. And then, you know, states and federal government can start rapidly, and I think they will rapidly, because Republicans are as horrified as Democrats by the fact that they have to spend half their day fundraising and begging from people. We can begin rapidly passing legislation that will get money out of politics. Once you get the money out of politics, the banks lose their power. And once they've lost their power, you can re-regulate them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the process.
And we can do other reforms, too. You mentioned quite a few of them. Why don't we just, one that stands out is the Robin Hood tax. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, this is pretty straightforward. We actually had this tax for a while. It was first put into place to finance the Spanish-American War back in 1898, I think it was. And then it went away for a few years after World War One. And then Franklin Roosevelt brought it back in 1933 when he created the Securities and Exchange Commission in order to pay for the SEC. And what it is a very, very small transaction tax on stock sales. So it's like, you know, 0.1%, maybe as much as 0.25% on every stock sale that happens. And for the average investor, for somebody who has, you know, a few thousand dollars in an IRA, or even a few hundred thousand, or even a few million in an IRA, this would be meaningless. It would be a tax that, even if they're fairly active in trading in their account, might amount to a few dollars a year, or a few dozen, or at the most a few hundred dollars if they're you know, if they've got millions in an IRA. But to a bank that makes, or a bankster, like there's 12 guys on Wall Street last year who each made more than $2 billion personally doing this high frequency trading nonsense and mm-hmm. speculation. Mm-hmm. To those people, it basically puts them out of business because their business model is based on no sales tax. And, you know, they're buying and selling commodities without sales tax. Now, you and I go into the store, we buy something, we pay sales tax on it. And so this is a very, 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 very tiny sales tax on stocks. And we stopped it in 1964 because it was making so much more money than the SEC cost that the conservatives came out and said, you know, let's just do away with this. And so they did away with it. And it was one of the deregulations that kind of tragically led to where we are now. And are certainly empowered the banks. So the step tax, the Robin Hood tax, is a very, very simple thing. Peter DeFazio is the main champion of this thing.
That's right, yes.
Uh-huh. Great congressman from Oregon, mm-hmm. and a good man. And that's one of many things that we could do. And I think we could do fairly easily if politicians could just say no to the big money people because they don't need them anymore.
Well, they also talk about a jubilee.
Yeah, we have, you know, in my father's generation, my dad went to college. He didn't graduate because mom got pregnant with me, and so he dropped out and mm-hmm. went to work in a steel mill. But he wanted to be a college history professor. And my wife's father actually went through college and got his law degree and became the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. Both of them went to school. To college, not just for free, they were paid a small stipend, you know, $100 a month to go to college, in addition to the cost of their books and everything else, through the GI Bill. They were both, you know, World War II vets. And so you had an entire generation, that generation of mostly young men, because they were in the war, although there were some women as well, who got free college educations through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, even. The GI Bill was paying benefits as late as the 70s. Through the GI Bill. And then at the same time, we also had, I mean, back in the 1850s, or in the 1860s, rather, early 1860s, Abraham Lincoln took massive amounts of federal land, gave it to states for the purposes of creating universities, over 54 of them, created the land-grant colleges, where the colleges had enough land that they could work that land and make enough money from working the land that they could provide free tuition to their students. My mom went to one of those colleges, Michigan State University, so did I briefly, but she mm-hmm. actually graduated from it. And she was able to put herself through college in the 40s working as a summer lifeguard in Charleroi. And she was from a very poor family. Her father died when she was 13, and her mom was just a clerk in the town in Charleroi. But she could put herself through college mm-hmm. by, you know, with a summer lifeguard job. I mean, wow. That's how cheap college was.
How times have changed.
Well, I mean, in the 60s, in the late 60s, I went to mm-hmm. Louise, my wife, put herself through college as a waitress at Howard Johnson's. Mm-hmm. I put myself through college to the extent that I did. I didn't graduate. As a DJ, a minimum wage DJ, and working at minimum wage in Bob's Big Boy as a cook and as a waiter and as mm-hmm. a dishwasher wow. at various times, and then pumping gas and changing tires in the Esso station.
Well, I think we're getting about the end of our time. We've been talking. Been talking with Tom Hartman, who wrote The Crash of 2016, and he will be talking about that book Friday, May 2nd, that's the day after tomorrow, at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Main. There'll be community tabling from 6 p.m. on, so it'll be a lot of opportunity to talk with community organizations, and then Tom and friends will be speaking at 7, so that is Friday, May 2nd. At the First Unitarian Church. So, Tom, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Per. It's been a pleasure and an honor, and I am always so pleased to be on KABU, and please get out there and contribute to KABU. It's a great station.
And everybody get out there Friday and listen to Tom and his friends talk about what to do with this economy we're stuck with. Thank you very much for being with us.
And coming right up on KABU, we've got Gerald Friedman will be the guest, speaking with Kathleen Stevenson. He's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of Reigniting the Labor Movement. And he will talk about the economic benefits of single-payer universal health care for low-wage workers, unions, and community groups. Don't forget, it's Air Cascadia at 10 o'clock, at 10:15 Flashpoints, and at 11 o'clock, the Radio Zine features a discussion about the shootings at Kent State long, long ago, and with some Vietnam vets here in the studio. Thanks again for joining up with KABU, those of you who have done it, and those of you who have not, go to kabu.fm and click on Donate Today. It's 9:31, and you're tuned to KABU.